Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you know, listen to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
It's Thursday evening. It's about 9 minutes to eight. It's July the 8th, 1982, and this time, more than any other time, Top of the Pops is doing it right. If you disregard Jonathan King's Cuntertainment USA, which we most certainly do. But the last 10 minutes of this episode of Top of the Pops is going to overlap with the first 10 minutes of a World Cup semi-final. Ooh. The boy Michael Hurl has done good so far, but he's going to have to pull out all the stops to prevent a mass switchover at 8 o'clock. Hey up, you pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to the final part of Chart Music 65. I'm Al Needham, and along with Neil Kulkarni and David Stubbs, let us rejoin the episode in progress.
Now, why wasn't that the German entry to the Eurovision Song Contest, we wonder? That's Trio, this week at number 30, in our top 30. Right, Odyssey, stay at number 3 with Inside Out.
Kid! Back with the Zoo Wankers, including the one I hate the most. Some twat with a tash and a bouffant, with what looks like Hulk Hogan's thong around his head. Regrets the fact that Da 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 wasn't the West German entry for Eurovision, while Hulk Hogan thong twat blows a kiss at us. I hate him. I've seen him on previous episodes of Chart Music, and I've always wanted to mention him, but he's not done anything yet, and now he has.
I love the fact you have a most hated Zoo member.
You've got to, haven't you? Have you got one, Neil?
I think it might be him. I think it might be the same guy, yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you had a particular dislike for that horrible smug twat dressed up as Dracula in that Halloween episode. I haven't seen him since. Up next, Inside Out by Odyssey. Formed in Stamford, Connecticut in 1975 from the ashes of the Lopez sisters, Odyssey consisted of Louise and Lillian Lopez and a rotating cast of male singers before settling on Bill McEachin, who immediately jumped on that disco train and rode it all the way to Chartland. In 1977, they lifted a track from Frankie Valli's latest LP, Native New Yorker, and had a whopping hit with it, getting to number 5 for 2 weeks in January of 1978. But management problems and an attempt to move away from disco resulted in 2 years in the wilderness until they roared back in 1980 with Use It Up and Wear It Out, which got to number 1 over here for 2 weeks in July of that year. This is the follow-up to It Will Be All Right, which got to number 43 in September of 1981. It's the lead-off cut from their new LP, Happy Together, and was written by Jesse Ray, the Scottish Braveheart of Funk, who was working with Bernie Worrell in the P-Funk band Space Cadets. Mm. They're apparently backed up by Slave, the Dayton Funk band best known for having Steve Arrington as their lead singer, and it's entered the top 40 at number 18 a fortnight ago, and this week it's jumped 4 places from number 7 to number 3. This fucking group and this fucking song. Chaps, Al Simons made mention of certain songs that, while you're hearing them, is the best single of all time. And I've got to say, this is one of mine.
Yeah.
And I was shocked to hear it on an episode of Top of the Pops as late as 1982, because I always peg it at 2 years earlier at least.
Mm. And the way Odyssey look is kind of out of date as well, especially the chap.
Oh, God,
you know,
yeah.
He looks like it could be from, 78, 77 sort of era.
Yeah, totally. I was just going to say that. It's party for Oxy. Yeah, they haven't sort of drunk the old Shalimar Kool-Aid yet, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
No.
This is their last ever appearance on Top of the Pops, this.
Yes. Mm. But what a way to go out.
Oh, yeah, their last top 40 hit. But you think of the run from Native New Yorker to this. It's amazing. But, I mean, for me, it's not actually this record that is my favourite Odyssey. I think it's I Cannot Get Over Looking for a Way Out. I fucking love that record.
Yeah.
I can't forget that. But, they're so great, Odyssey. Lillian Lopez, what a fucking voice. And she's also, in this performance, she does this thing she repeatedly does, actually. Remember when I was telling you way back when, I think probably the first Chart Music I ever did, how scared I was of Kate Bush and her wide eyes. Lillian Lopez does that all the time as well. It's quite creepy. But this is a wonderful record. Wonderful record.
Mm. Like you say, Odyssey are clearly not 1982 people. Mm. The Lopez sisters are 47 and 49 respectively. And they're there wearing very ornate dresses in the Lopez sisters.
Almost looks like a sari.
Mm. Yes, I was going to say that.
Yeah.
So they're wearing that. And Bill McEachin's come as Big Bill Werbenuck, hasn't he?
Yeah.
In his snooker outfit. And they're doing not much of anything. There's no real... There's a kind of a cursory wave at a routine.
Mm.
But who gives a toss? The single is doing all the work.
Exactly.
It's a glorious
single. It is. And I really wouldn't want it any other way than it is. The only slightly disappointing thing was actually old David Jensen's intro, old kid's intro. He just says, Odyssey, you built up a large fan base in the UK because they're constantly touring. Is that it? I thought you were going to get a quip or something like that, a really half-arsed Noel Edmonds-type quip or something like that. Or of the sort he's been sort of attempting throughout the show. I just thought it was a strangely flat. It's a very, very boring fact indeed, really. It's really barely a fact, really. That's the only note of disappointment. This is a beautiful, magnificent single.
Mm.
And the fact that, I mean, Slave, who were fantastic, you know, they're really sort of undersung as Slave. Their involvement is great.
Just a Touch of Love is a fucking tune.
Oh, it's a fucking tune, man. Did that ever get in charts here? We're never going to see that on Top of the Pops, are we?
No, we're not.
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, Watching You, all that kind of stuff. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely excellent. I mean, I just love the way that the slap bass keeps sort of picking, it's really sort of high and keeps sort of popping up through the mix, you know. There's actually something strangely understated, in a sense, about the whole vocal performance. It's enigmatic in a sense, but all praise to Jesse Ray.
Oh, God, yes.
What a cat. I mean, like, he lived in America for a while. He became a runner in the New York Stock Exchange just to sort of make his money with that. And that's how he met Roger Troutman and Bernie Worrell, and obviously made such a strong impression on them. You know, when he did his own solo stuff in the late 80s, they all sort of dutifully came out to the Highlands, whatever, and performed on these videos that he did.
Over the Sea. Mentioned before, fucking amazing.
That's right, yeah.
That should have been a hit.
Yeah.
I mean, Jonathan King should have been sent up to Scotland to fucking do his bit.
And I just love the fact that, you know, he just didn't hold back. There was so much kind of sort of Scottish, you know, wet, wet, wet type sort of white soul at the moment. And I thought, now this is what you want. You want, you know, absolutely mega funky, but unapologetically Scottish as Jesse Ray was.
Scottish people are fucking mad into funk, though, aren't they? When I was in London, if I ever met a Scottish person, it would be about a 75% chance that we'd end up talking about Sly and the Family Stone. I went to that Sly and the Family Stone gig in Bournemouth, fucking hell, about 12 years ago. And I just ran into a gang of proper meaty Scottish lads from Glasgow. And they were fucking mint. We were gabbling on for ages about funk and what we were into and what we grew up on and all that kind of stuff. They'd had a hotel room. I was planning on sleeping out on the beach and getting the first train home. He says, nah, come back. Come back to the hotel. We'll get pissed up. It was like, yeah, fucking brilliant. And I lost their phone number. And I've always wanted to thank them. So if they are listening, respect to you, my dears.
Yeah. And of course, this song is rightly revered and beloved and very, very well known. But I would definitely encourage anybody to seek out anything by Jesse Ray on YouTube or whatever.
Yes.
And just, you know, in his full kilt and regalia and armour and whatnot. And, but, you know, as you say, it's an absolutely logical link. And I just thought it was an absolutely brilliant riposte to all that kind of Marty Pelloism and, you know, that type of, that was emanating from Scotland at the time, you know. But he's such, also politically, he's so strange because basically, obviously, as you can imagine, he's a Scottish nationalist, is Jesse Ray. But he wants to take it further. First of all, he wants Scotland to get its independence, and then for the sort of Scottish border regions, you know, Berwickshire, to declare their independence from the rest of Scotland, you know, I think.
Blimey.
he's on a mission.
This record, you kind of don't want it to end. You do need it to end in the context of Top of the Pops, but whenever I listen to it, it's like, I don't know, I know it's not looped in on itself, but it almost is. You don't want it to end because the lyrics, they've got no narrative to them. It's about those first few weeks of love when you're so bound up with someone. It's amazing, this record.
Well, it's a bit more than that, Neil. It's about being in love with someone who's with someone else.
Well,
at the moment,
there's that as well. But it's just this beautiful, gaseous, glowing kind of beautiful thing. It's just full of desire, this record. Yeah. And it's just unrequited desire, but a lovely place to be. You just don't want it to end.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, the bit where it goes inside, out, and the bass goes fucking mental. It's just like, no, can we have this for like half an hour? And again, it's another example of Britain adopting and cherishing American songs that can't get played in their own country because disco sucks. Fuck off.
Absolutely. And it's as funky as it is soulful.
Yeah.
And
yes,
as soulful as it is funky. And that sounds almost trite, but there's not an awful lot you can say that about. And that perhaps might be something that is extinct these days. It may not be actually possible for whatever reason, in time, to make a record like this. It belongs, you know, it's obviously eternal, but it belongs to all of its era. It could only really be made at a certain time.
And coming after Jonathan King telling us that the Americans, we should be listening to a Deuce fucking Newton and John Cougar, you know.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah.
The standout song of this episode for
one
me.
One of them.
Thank fuck it's still early enough in the episode that I wouldn't have missed it.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So Inside Out would spend one more week at number three, its highest position. The follow-up, Magic Touch, stalled at number 41 in September, and they never troubled the top 40 again. Although the band are still going to this day, it's a complete Triggers Broom situation, as both Lopez sisters died last decade and McEachin retired a while back. Oh, we'll see you soon, though, Odyssey. You feature in a lot of early 80s episodes of Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
Yes, their performance is somewhat dated, their clothes are somewhat dated, but it could have been so much worse. A couple of weeks before this, Zoo dance to this.
Yes, they did.
Record. And
Fucking God.
Scrape my eyes out.
I think that was the last performance of Zoo as a dance troupe.
Yeah. They wouldn't let him do it after that because it was so fucking rubbish what they do to this record.
Yeah.
They almost take the piss out of it, you know? And that's what really aggravates me about Zoo's performance of this.
It's sad them being dead. I just remember there was a certain time when I realised that astronauts and disco stars were dying of old age, and that sort of somewhat depressed me.
Thanks, David.
Inside out, hold on.
Odyssey, who build up a large fan following in the UK because they're constantly touring, and that's number three, Inside Out. Right, it's time to go to the electric scoreboard now and check out the charts. New at number 30, it's Trio and Da Da Da. At number 29, up one for Dollar and Videotech. At 28, Goody Two Shoes from Adam Ant. Heart Stop Beating in Time from Leo Sayer is at 27. At 26, Do I Do, Stevie Wonder. At 25, Soft Cell with Torch. At 24, I Want Candy, Bow Wow Wow. With ABC at 23, The Look of Love. At number 22, up from 28, Lynyrd Skynyrd and Freebird. At 21, it's Night Train from Visage. And at number 20, Bananarama. And here they are with Shy Boy.
Kid next to some of the kids and a zoo wanker on another zoo wanker's shoulders just in case we don't see them tells us that Odyssey are big in the UK because they're always touring. Then he whips us into the first third of the charts, settling upon Shy Boy by Bananarama. We've already discussed Bananarama on chart music number 27 when they and the Funboy 3 struggled to be picked out amongst a blizzard of zoo wankers and balloons while recording Really Saying Something, which got to number 5 for 2 weeks in May of this year. This is the follow-up of sorts to that, and not only is it their first single since the Fun Boy 3 gave them a leg up into the charts, it's their first non-cover version, written by their new producers Steve Jolly and Tony Swain, the knob twiddlers behind Imagination. Originally called Big Red Motorbike, which the group didn't like at all and demanded a lyric change, it was released just over a fortnight ago, entered the charts at number 61 last week, and this week it soared 21 places to number 20. And although there's a video, directed by Midyore and Chris Cross of Ultravox, where the Romas give a spod, played by Terry Sharp, the boyfriend of Sarah Darlene and future lead singer of The Adventures, a makeover, here they are in the studio. Let's get into them chart pictures first, chaps, because as always at this time of Top of the Pops gestation period, they're pretty and sadly professional in the main, aren't they?
They are. There's no. I didn't spot a single oddity amongst the charts.
No, got one or two.
I love you.
I mean, Trio are wearing the same clothes as they did in the Top of the Pops performance, leading me to believe that the BBC didn't have an actual image of them and hustled them outside for a last-minute photo shoot.
Yeah, very probably. So, yeah.
There's that great photo of Soft Cell poncing about with oversized musical notes, which pops up quite regularly on Top of the Pops.
It does, and I think it's on the front cover of The Art of Dancing, isn't it?
Ah, there we go then.
Yeah.
There's a really 70s-looking washed-out photo of Dollar, when they should have used the picture of them in this week's Record Mirror when they're all Japanese'd up. Have you seen that one?
Oh, my gosh, no. I can only imagine.
Therese is all geisha'd up, and David Van Day's gone full samurai. David Van Day's the water margin, if you will.
All the cultural sensitivity of sort of Japanese boy, basically.
Yes, exactly. There's a satisfyingly crappy shot of Ronnie Van Zant bellowing into a microphone with a big hat on for Freebird, because that's been re-released. There's a bit of a Greb revival going on. And a pic of Bananarama looking extremely pissed off at the fact that they've got to hold up some inflatable bananas.
Yes.
Kind of like predating football terrace culture by a good 10 years or so, but they're still not happy about it, are they?
Yeah, they're doing it. It's under protest, you know, but perhaps that's the whole idea. You know, perhaps they concede, you know, the idea. And let's hold up some bananas and make out we're pissed off about it. That'd be very, very meta, very post-punk.
So this performance then, I mean, the good thing about it is that it looks like three of the better-dressed women in the audience have come on stage to do a turn. Mm. And in this case, that's the bad thing too, because let's get this out from the off. To me, this is no really saying something.
Well, you say it's their first non-cover, and it is a cover of Come See About Me, basically. It's very much a cover. The thing is, you know, as a poptimist, I should be into this. I should really support Bananarama as a kind of counterpoint to lad rock and lad pop, but it's tremendously difficult holding something like Shy Boy up as anything other than a record, really, in which everyone, us and Bananarama themselves, really, are being entirely cynically manipulated. You said there that they didn't look like they were happy in the shot of them holding bananas up. I mean, the key thing for me with Bananarama, really throughout their career, is that never post their work with Funboy 3, they never look like they're enjoying being pop stars, to be honest with you. There's always this kind of sense of manipulation, sense of stuff that they're uncomfortable with. I mean, I realise that this record is never going to be a powerhouse Motown-type song. I realise that the point of Bananarama is their weakness, in a sense, vocally. This isn't music for girls to sing along to in their bedroom mirror. This isn't sort of Betty Everett doing the sheep shoots. It's the sound of girls singing along in their bedroom mirror, in a sense. You know, there's no harmonies in Bananarama's music. They all sing the same note. And that kind of amateurism can be really endearing. But the trouble is, what I find here, what's sad about this, it's obviously a tremendously exciting period for the girls. But I think here be the seeds of problems that they face later on. You do have to wonder how much autonomy they're exerting over their appearance. And, you know, this single, the B-side, Don't Call Us, is better because it's theirs. It's them, their own song. Yeah. There's an interview with, oddly enough, another sort of all-female band, but obviously completely different, The Raincoats, in 1982 that I've read, where Vicky from The Raincoats, she talks about girls being bought into ornament groups, and she's talking about the Human League. Now, by then, I think the girls in the League have totally proved themselves, but Bananarama certainly become, in this period, a target for that kind of idea of manipulation, really thanks to records like this, because it's a weak-sounding record, They sound kind of bored, which can sometimes be a good thing, but they feel and they look on this appearance, they feel a bit pushed around, a bit pushed into this. And I know that's the bargain that they're accepting. Do this, get hits, don't feel particularly happy about it. But it always made Bananarama for me a little bit uncomfortable in a sense to really get into, you know?
Yeah, Neil, because when we covered Bananarama, when they did Really Saying Something in a previous Top of the Pops, we were all for them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they came off as the three older girls sitting on a wall that if, you know, they nodded at you and acknowledged your existence, that was a really big deal. And there was a dubbiness to Really Saying Something that lifted their take on a Motown song.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's gone now, and it leaves their singing abilities exposed.
Yeah.
So while you could appreciate their take on a Velvet single, with this original song, you're left wondering what the Velvets and the Motown house band could have done with it. And a bit more than this, I'm afraid to say.
Well, the thing is, Bananarama, they're punks, and they're post-punk girls, you know? Mm. And that's why their work with Funboy 3 suited it. Now they are being pushed into this new kind of type of pop for the 80s, and it'll befit them, I think, a little bit. I mean, don't, of course it doesn't, because they end up having a fair few hits, but at no point, I don't think they're enjoying, I think already, then we're obviously years before the pizza incident that blows the band apart, but you know, I sense already they're not enjoying this.
No, it's interesting, Neil, that you say that, because I think in a sense that suspicion is kind of vindicated by when they hooked up with Stock Aitken and Waterman.
Mm,
However, I'm a lot more positive about this single than you two chaps, and I was at the time. I really liked it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think before, it was just, why did they seem to get so much press? I mean, obviously, you know, there's the fanciability factor, but I think they used to work as sort of press officers. They used to come up to music press officers before my time and sort of hand out vinyl, you know, to journos and editors and probably, you know, build a rapport that way. So there was probably a sense among journalists that there were some of us, as it were.
Yeah.
Similar
thing
with Emma out of Lush. I remember that when she did that.
Right.
But I do like this. And I think there is a sort of kinship with Human League, what I was talking about earlier on, in a sense. There's a certain effortlessness, not in the Usain Bolt sense of qualifying for the 100 metres final, you know, in the semis, looking like he's strolling through. That, not that, but a sort of lack of, I don't know, lycra-busting strenuousness that you get from the 1990s onwards, that era in pop when women in pop become re-objectified. Frankly, you know, there's a certain withering disdain about them. There's a little half smile that Karen gives to the camera on the line every minute we're together, and it reminds me of a similar smile that Joanne out of Human League does in the video to Keep Feeling Fascination. You know, it's a sort of, you know, it's a half smile. It's very sarcastic. It's, you know, it's got, you know, they're out of sync when they're dancing, and that's great. I mean, whack a handbag down there on the stage, and that'd be about the size of it. And if those geezers from Only Fools and Horses, like Mickey Pierce and his mate, come sidling up to, they'll just mouth, piss off, and without missing a beat. You know, there's that. You know, I like all of that.
Mm. I like them. I mean, I always like Sarah, her iciness. She never cracked a smile, as far as I was aware, throughout the 80s. So, yeah, I do like them. I found the song a little bit weak. Perhaps I'm reading in later Bananarama problems into what they're going through at this point. Maybe they're completely happy doing this, and they've got a big hit all by themselves without having to, you know, have some male band introduce them. So it is a successful moment for them.
Yes.
But I just never got the feeling with Bananarama they enjoyed success much.
No, well, they're shooting each other looks as they're performing and cocking a leg and lifting a knee and all that kind of stuff, as if to say, what the fuck are we doing here? You know, we've been through this week's NME, where they were interviewed on Music Laden, and I've seen that performance, and it's fucking brilliant, simply because the Funboy 3 are on there as well. The audience are a typical European pop audience, like bored shitless, not reacting to anything. And Terry Hall's exactly the same performing on the stage. So you get this feedback of boredom between him and the audience. It's fucking great.
And I think that is okay. It's kind of mandatory. When I was a kid at school, one of the worst things you could do was have a cheapie, i.e. be over-enthusiastic about something.
Yes.
You know, he's having a cheapie there, isn't he? You know, you really have to curb your enthusiasm. And I think that was kind of mandatory at this era of punk. You know, it's I mean, if one thing slightly lets them down, it's what they're wearing.
Oh, God, yes.
It is distinctly zoo wankerish. But in every other respect, they are the antithesis of zoo wankerdom.
I mean, they're all mainly in white with sort of colourful bits and bobs here and there. You know, they're wearing banana... Well, one or two of them are wearing Bananarama vests, obviously. Mm. Unfortunately, in Karen and Siobhan's case, their outfit involves baggy shorts that just look like massive nappies.
So they
end up looking like Pamela Stevenson... pretending to be Claire Grogan on Not the 9 o'clock News.
Yes, there is a bit of that.
And
there.
By this point, I'm starting to wonder what Jimmy Greaves is saying about Germans on the other side.
Yeah,
I mean, Bananarama is one of those bands where you do have to take their singles on a case by case basis.
Yeah,
and this one, no, it's not doing anything for me.
Do it for me. I mean, what normally happens with bands is that they start exerting more control as time goes on. I think it's the opposite with Bananarama, and by the time they're working with Static and Waterman, they really feel pushed around, and they're not enjoying it at all.
No.
At least here we're getting a sense of joy. There is a really powerful sense amongst them and in between each other. The looks that they're shooting at each other are exactly what you said, Al. It's they can't believe they're on Top of the Pops doing this, you know. And that is always wonderful to see. And I celebrate the slight amateurism. I celebrate the fact that musically they're not harmonising. They're just all singing it like girls would, who were teenage girls who were singing along to this in their mirror, much like their fans would end up being. But at the same time, do I want to hear it again? Not sure.
No.
Not sure if I want to hear it again. No. But a good presence in pop, and certainly useful for the music press, in as much as putting Bananarama on the cover in 1982 makes a statement of a sort, definitely, about what kind of music you think the future should look like.
So the following week, Shy Boy soared 11 places to number 9, and a week later it got to number 4, its highest position. But already the group were dissatisfied with Swain and Jolly, claiming that they wouldn't let them record their own songs and wanted them to be an 80s update of the 60s girl group, and the partnership was immediately dissolved. Linking up with Barry Blue, they put out the self-penned Cheers then, which only got to number 45 in December, and was slagged off in Smash Hits for sounding a bit like the Coffee Tastes Nicer with Coffee Mate advert jingle. So they reunited with Swain and Jolly and roared back to number 5 in March of 1983 with a cover of Na Na Hey Hey Kiss Him Goodbye, with a video featuring them roaring off into the night on 3 big red motorbikes. And Shy Boy had an infamous afterlife in February of 1983 when Channel 4 broadcast the first episode of Mini Pops, a show produced by Mike Mansfield featuring extremely young kids dressing up and karaokeing the hits of the day, featuring 3 frizzy-haired tots singing "He Gives Me Loving Like Nobody Else, I Like the Way He Turns Me On." Which led to an outraged letter to Channel 4's Right to Reply, which read, "Mini Pops should be called Mini Whores. Are you people out of your mind?"
Oh my God.
Fucking hell, Mini Pops. Yeah.
Is it the children's fault? Yes, it's the children's fault.
Oh, did you ever see that, though?
No. I did, and even as a kid. Mm.
Even as a kid, you felt like a paedophile.
It's vile. I mean, as a kid, really is. Immediately spot it was totally dodgy and just should not have happened, let alone on Channel 4, you know.
I know.
Very shocking that even ever existed. And those 3 girls doing that song, it's deeply unpleasant, not only because of what they're wearing, but they're made up as well, heavily made up, as I recall.
Oh, total, man.
Yeah.
The Homer Simpson makeup gun.
Yeah.
Fully deployed.
Well, exactly. And coupled with those lyrics, God, it's horrific.
I don't think Mike Mansfield realised how sexual lyrics were getting by 1983. I'd love to do a bonus episode of Chart Music where we do that, but it's just...
You could not sit through a whole fucking episode of that. I mean,
it is on YouTube, everyone. Bits of it. At your own risk.
Mini Pops is just immensely bizarre because it's when one tries to identify who would watch that. You cannot answer that question without, a host of ne'er-do-wells and characters. Yeah. It's just appalling. Who the fuck would watch that?
I think it was supposed to be something for the olden's.
I know.
And something for the kids. But the kids would fucking hate it.
Oh, God, yeah.
Simply because, that kid there, they're famous and I'm not. Fuck them. I mean, kids singing pop songs is one of the greatest things in life ever. I've got a video of my niece when she was 6 singing I Love Rock and Roll while I'm playing it on Guitar Hero. And it's the most brilliant thing ever. But that's because she's so fucking amateurish
and thinks
it's called Put Another Dime in the Dewdrop, Baby.
Yeah, whereas all the kids on mini pops are all like stage school pushy parents. Yeah. It's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'd have Jimmy Savile wanking in his caravan, you know, but...
David. Neil, before we go, explain the pizza incident.
Oh, the pizza incident was one of the major things that broke up Bananarama, or at least that led to Siobhan leaving.
Right.
It was down to... They all shared a flat, obviously. A lot of... I mean, if you're going to share a flat with people, that is... Especially people that you're in a band with, that you then have to sort of tour with and do everything with. It's a recipe for disaster. I think the pizza incident was the one that shoved them over the edge, in as much as there was a slice of pizza on the floor that had attracted cockroaches. And, it caused a massive argument, because I think it was Siobhan that left this slice of pizza on the floor. Boom, Siobhan leads the band.
Ugh.
Yeah. Over that pizza slice and that cockroach, which, to be honest with you, is better than most of the reasons that bands split up. It's a more legitimate reason, I would argue, than musical differences.
Yes.
Kieran, Sarah and Siobhan, collectively Bananarama, and that's Shy Boy. Right, that's number 20. Let's go zooming back up the charts. At 19, Roxy Music with Avalon. Up 3 to 18, it's Murphy's Law from Cherie. Las Palabras de Amor from Queen is at 17. At 16, Hungry Like the Wolf, Duran Duran. AC/DC's For Those About to Rock is at 15. At 14, Wonderful Thing from Kid Creole and the Coconuts. At 13, up from 20, Bucks Fizz and Now Those Days Are Gone. At 12, it's Ico Ico from Natasha. At number 11, the Beatles movie medley. Now we're going to put our engines into reverse thrust, go back to number 13, and catch up with Bucks Fizz with Now Those Days Are Gone.
Of another failed attempt to integrate the zoo wankers and the normal people, Kid handles a second part of the top 30 before rewinding and coming forward with Now Those Days Are Gone by Bucks Fizz. We seem to have accidentally become the world's leading podcast authority on Bucks Fizz, and this, their sixth single, is the follow-up to My Camera Never Lies, which became their third number one single in April, ending the foul reign of Seven Tears by the Gumbay Dance Band, and giving way after a week to Ebony and Ivory by Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder. It's the third cut from their second LP, Are You Ready?, which came out at the end of April, was given a 10 out of 10 review in Smash Hits, and got to number 10 in the album charts. And it entered the top 40 3 weeks ago at number 37, then soared 17 places to number 20, and this week it's jumped 7 places to number 13. So here's the video, which was partly shot in Hyde Park and features Mike Nolan as lead singer for the first time on a Bucks Fizz single.
Mm-hmm.
Well, chaps, this video starts at the exact same moment that the World Cup semi-final does, and I'm afraid to say you can practically hear the ricochet of the ITV1 buttons clicking right across the country.
Oh, no doubt. Like a shot. Yeah.
Shameful. I mean, was this deliberate scheduling by Hull? I mean, we've said he's front-loaded all the good stuff, and this is definitely the arse end of the episode, as we're going to find out.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, most of us will have seen this video well before this appearance of it on Top of the Pops, so we definitely don't need to see it again. Nothing miraculous is going to happen in this video that hasn't happened in this video before. And, of course, the video misses the key moment of the filming of the video. Yeah, you know, the swan attack.
Yes.
On is it Bobby or Mike who gets attacked by swans?
It's Bobby.
It's Bobby, and I believe he was mildly injured in this.
Yeah, he had to be dragged away by the camera crew.
Oh, man.
Because we all know what swans can break.
They can.
The Frank Baird of the animal world, that is. Size of a dinner plate.
Well, quite. Never trust mute creatures, swans, rabbits. Just don't trust them.
If Top of the Pops has said, stay to the end because we're going to see that swan attack for the first time. We're going to recreate it in the studio. Oh, yeah. Bobby G is going to be in a cage fighting with loads of swans. Don't turn over to the World Cup. You don't want to miss it.
Well, I mean, we would have stayed without a doubt, of course.
Yeah. Mm. Before we get into all this Bucks Fizz goodness, let's rewind a bit and go through them chart picks because, you know, there's one or two interesting ones. Roxy Music.
Yeah. Old Brian Ferry looks like the manager of a nightclub who's come out to have a sort of diplomatic word with a difficult punter. But
exactly.
By a couple of his bouncers, doesn't he?
No trainers, tracksuits or baseball caps in Brian Ferry's club, I'm afraid. Brian Johnson looks like an angry dad trying to tell Angus Young that he's a big lad now and shouldn't be on his shoulders anymore. Bucks Fizz themselves are basically a four-torsoed Blake Seven villain, aren't they? Natasha, with Ico Ico, I believe, standing in front of some space invaders, which is incredibly passé by the summer of 1982, don't you think? It's all Donkey Kong round here now, isn't it?
It's all Donkey Kong and Defender.
Yes.
You know, definitely.
And they've just slapped up the cover of Let It Be for the Beatles movie medley, so, because, you know, who gives a fuck? It's only the Beatles, after all. So, yes, chaps, chart music, you know, it's been a voyage of discovery for all of us. Mm. And two things I've learned is that Bucks Fizz seem to be on Top of the Pops all the fucking time in the first half of the 80s. And more importantly, and more frighteningly, I've come to realise that, you know what, Bucks Fizz are actually all right, you know. I mean, we've not done My Camera Never Lies yet, but that is one of the maddest number one singles of the decade. It just goes all over the shop, and it's like, oh, fucking hell, this is all right, actually.
Well, it's, you know, it is telling, like you said, the album that this is from, it gets 10 out of 10 in Smash
Yes.
Hits. And the review, I've read it, is extremely positive about the songwriting and everything else.
No.
In 81, I needed Bucks Fizz for a bit of national pride, you know. But by 82, yeah. I still needed them. Even though I was seeing them as shit already, or starting to see them as a little shit, you kind of needed Bucks Fizz to be the centre of pop.
Yes.
To make your own ordinance kind of away from that centre more plain. You do need a figurehead of the mainstream.
Yeah.
To make your musical choices a little bit more interesting. And Bucks Fizz are definitely sort of stepping into that come 82 with videos like this. And their total real, I mean, let's be honest, their inheritance of the ABBA mantle, if you like.
Yes.
I mean, I think they've gone beyond Brotherhood of Man here.
Oh, God, yes.
And they are so, not as big as ABBA in terms of how many years of success they've had, but they're doing very ABBA-like songs, as this one is as well.
Yes. I mean, 1982 is Bucks Fizz's imperial phase, isn't it? They've already got two number ones under their belt, and it's still only July. And it's only them and The Jam who managed two number one singles in 1982, let's not forget. But the thing about them was they just couldn't or didn't want to break out of their family-friendly, end-of-the-pier, crackerjack ghetto.
Well, perhaps at some certain level, certainly. I mean, it feels like they are definitely trying to shake off the shaking ABBA thing, obviously, by this stage.
Shabba.
It's Shabba.
Shabba.
Yeah. You know, and this is very ambitious, and it was actually nominated for an Ivor Novello Award.
Yes.
I mean, you know, and those dresses are definitely staying on. There's no doubt
yes.
about it.
Yes.
They're serious now. Perhaps they feel that this is the moment at which they kind of ascend way, way, like in the balloon of beyond Brotherhood of Man, certainly, indeed. And, you know, they join a pantheon, I don't know, Jacques Brel, Tim Rice, Bacharachs, you know, the sort of, you know, the realm of like mature songwriting and craftsmanship.
Yeah.
Little do they know that right down at number 29 of the charts is an interloper in waiting, like Corporal Hitler in 1918, who's going to fuck them right up a few years down the line. But the great Bob Stanley described this as Home County's potting shed balladry of the highest order.
Yes.
They were ruthless at this time, Bucks Fizz.
I mean, this is an obvious play for the Radio 2 audience, isn't it? And that's Radio 2 in the old money. I mean, I can imagine Cliff Richard absolutely fucking fuming he wasn't offered this while he's pouring another bucket of child blood on his vineyard.
Well, quite. I mean, look, Bucks Fizz, they could easily have taken wall space in the old people's home that I was living in, you know, next to Torval and Dean and that. I mean, they're ruthless at this time.
Yeah.
Three number one singles, and they're each selling half a million. Only the Human League beat that in this period. Oddly enough,
that's
by the
amazing,
way.
Isn't
yeah, it?
It
is. And oddly enough, Bucks Fizz are offered this year, in fact, a 50-minute TV special on Easter Monday, which ends up falling through. It never happens.
Oh.
But Bobby has said that their guests were going to be the Human League. And I mean, who knows where that might have ended up?
Oh man!
Especially seeing as the, you know, the Books Fizz live show at the time included a medley of My Kind of Life, Hot Stuff, Do You Think I'm Sexy, and Rocking All Over the World. So where Good Human Lord. League would have fitted into that? Who the fuck knows? But,
talking about their tour, it's another example of them kind of like downplaying themselves a little bit. You know, surely band with three number ones, you can command some pretty big venues.
Yeah.
Their tour, which starts next month, takes in seaside resorts and Mansfield Leisure Centre is down there on one of their dates. And their support act is Bob Carroll, Jeez and Spit the Dog.
But that is them, isn't it? They were uncomfortably in between the two. But I mean, you know, these are venues that Dollar wouldn't play. Books Fizz should probably be playing the sort of venues that Dollar are playing, if not bigger. I mean, they're enormous at this point.
Why isn't Paul Morley banging on about Books Fizz?
That's a really good question.
I think he might have done, you know, actually. I think he might have done. Not to the same extent as Bananarama, who he did bang on a great deal about, and Dollar, certainly, of course. Yeah. I think Eurovision is always a big thing to have to live down, really. And you don't necessarily see.
Yeah.
But they've done it. They're a standalone group now, aren't they?
Very much so. Making songs that I think the two words that most apply to them are expertly crafted. And that's what this is, you know? I mean, even though, for me, it's gagging for a kind of ABBA-like pulse behind it, it works. It works as a piece of nostalgia for the people that, you know, might take it that way. But it also works as just a nice bit of harmonised pop. The only trouble is, it's a cappella for a long bit. That always has that little bit of a cappella smuggery. It kind of reminds me quite a lot, this, of the New Seekers anthem from 1976. It's kind of similar. But, I mean, the video in itself, much like all Books Fizz videos, they'd started becoming events of a sort.
They're doing something for the olders in this video, which takes us all the way back to the 40s, don't you know? Bobby G, in his RAF togs, is essentially taking time out from giving the Luftwaffe biffing by slapping it about with both Rita Crudgington, who looks so fucking 40s. Looks like she's just walked off the set of Shine On, Harvey Moon, man. She was born too late, that woman. And Jay Aston, who's essentially playing Jane in the old Daily Mirror cartoon. And in the meantime, Mike Nolan's in an old school radio studio with one of them proper microphones in a dinner jacket, ruining the 40s effect by keeping his Lady Di hairstyle on.
Yes.
The only thing that's missing from this is David Van Day in a stuka with an iron cross hanging from his throat.
Yeah.
To be fair, both the boys in Books Fizz are letting the side down a bit, I think. The two girls, they look convincingly wartime.
Yes.
But if you had hair like Bobby or Mike in the 1940s...
7 days jankers. Yes.
You'd have been shot as a fifth columnist or something. Yes. So, yeah. You know, and also, how have they got bread to feed all these geese in the park? You know, don't they know there's a fucking war on?
Do you know it's bread, though? It might be powdered egg or something.
It might be, but, you know, they're using up one of their ration coupons.
Yeah, traitors.
You're right, they only semi-commit to it, really, don't they? It's funny you talk about, like, taking us back to the 40s. That, of course, is today it wouldn't have taken us back to the 80s.
Yeah.
Which I think just goes to show that certainly in pop time, you know, there are decades and there are decades, you know, because the 1980s are much closer to the 2020s than the 1940s were to the 1980s.
Well, exactly, David, because at the very end of the video, we see G and Baker sat on a bench, and then they transform into what I assume is an elderly version of them 40 years later, which is pretty much what they would be now. But the 68-year-old Cheryl Baker and Bobby Gubby certainly don't look like that today. Fucking hell.
Oddly enough, I remember lying to my mate and saying that the old couple at the end were Books Fizz made up.
Right.
That they were Cheryl and Bobby made up. He believed it. I know it might seem that I was a lying little cunt back then. I just spent my whole time conning the credulous. But I'm sure I wasn't the only person to, you know, have a second look at that video sometimes. I think, oh, that could be them, you know?
We need to go back to that old people looking like actual old people.
Yeah, too right. This is a really, really competent song that is going to mop up a big part of the pop market. But its appearance at this point, yeah, I would absolutely be fucking killing myself to turn over to the 40 by now.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you mentioned a pulse. You know, anything that didn't have a pulse to me, it was just dead to me, basically, at this point.
I mean, we're 2 months away from the first anniversary of Bugs Fizz winning Eurovision, right, which was made quite a big deal of by the band and the media, which is mental because it's only a year. But the fact that everyone seems to be commemorating it sort of signifies that they have moved on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, oh yeah, do you remember we did this? Mm. Every single after Making Your Mind Up was almost like a gradual step away from that.
Oh yeah, look, the fact that we are even remembering Bugs Fizz a year after their Eurovision appearance is a miraculous achievement in itself.
Yes.
So the fact that they're having huge hit albums, huge hit tours and all the rest of it. And I do recommend people seek out the 10 out of 10 Smash Hits review. Mm. This was not a band that could easily be castigated as Eurovision cheese. They were taken seriously as a pop band.
Mm. So the following week, Now Those Days Are Gone nipped up 5 places to number 8, its highest position. The follow-up saw them take another swerve and transform into Fox Biz when they took If You Can't Stand the Heat to number 10 in January of 1983.
Oh, yeah.
And 24 years later, Now Those Days Are Gone became the only official Bugs Fizz release to contain obscene language when the demo, recorded by co-songwriter Andy Hill, was put out on their Lost Masters 2, the final cut anthology of unreleased songs and off cuts. Yeah, he F's and Jeff's a bit at the end. It's disgusting.
Disgraceful. When we were going wrong, now those days are
gone. Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Is there, of course. Honestly, I'm not really this short. It's just that they're standing on a ledge above me. Let's go back on the chart. At number 10, Work That Body, Diana Ross. Mitch Ure's at number 9, last week 11, No Regrets. At number 8, up 5 for The Jam, Just Who Is the 5 O'Clock Hero. At 7, I've Never Been to Me from Charlene. Shalimar with A Night to Remember is at number 6. Still at 5, Imagination with Music and Lights. Irene Cara's Fame, the highest new entry at number 4. At 3, Inside Out from Odyssey. This week's number 2 from the Steve Miller Band is Abracadabra. And incredibly at number 1 once again, it's the wonderful Captain Sensible. And here he is with Dolly Mixture performing Happy Talk.
Back amongst the zoo wankers, breaks down the top 10 before alighting on this week's number 1, Happy Talk by Captain Sensible. Born in Balham in 1954, Raymond Burns began his career as a member of the proto-punk band Johnny Moped in the mid-70s, before being invited by Malcolm McLaren to join a new group called Masters of the Backside, which featured Dave Vanian, Rat Scabies and Chrissie Hynde in 1976. The band fell apart after one gig, but the non-female members decided to stick together and form a new group, The Damned, who immediately signed to Stiff Records. In August of 1976, while a coach party of bands, including Eddie and the Hot Rods and the Pink Fairies, were waiting to depart for the first European punk festival at Mount de Marsan in France, Burns got his name when he turned up pissed out of his skull in a shirt festooned with epaulettes and lurched up and down the aisles, pretending to be an airline pilot, leading someone to exclaim, "Oh, it's fucking Captain Sensible," and the name stuck. Although the Damned are credited with releasing the first ever punk single, New Rose, in October of 1976, and the first punk LP, Damned, 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 in February of 1977, they split up in early 1978, and Sensible was invited by the band's former road manager to front a Dutch band called the Softies to record a cover of Jet Boy, Jet Girl, an Elton Matello single which utilised a backing track put together by the godlike Luda Prick of Two Man Sound, which he later put out himself under the name Plastic Bertrand, called Sa Plan Pour Moi. Due to the lyrical content, about a 15-year-old boy in a gay relationship with an older man who he wants to kill because he's now got a girlfriend, it was strangely never released in the UK. In the spring of 1979, the Damned reformed and finally broke into the charts when Love Song got to number 20 in May and Smash It Up got to number 35 in October, but diminishing returns started to set in. By 1981, when Sensible noted that loads of people at Damned gigs had Crass logos stenciled on their leather jackets, he linked up with Penny Rambo and spent a week with him at Dial House, Crass's anarcho-pacifist open house, and together they worked on his first solo release, the This Is Your Captain Speaking EP, which was released on Crass Records with a cover of Sensible's face on the body of his pet rabbit in November of 1981. It got to number 3 in the independent chart. Earlier this year, while the Damned were still active, he landed a solo deal with A&M and was linked up with the producer-musician Tony Mansfield, a former member of the Nick Straker band who had just split up New Music, the band he had fronted since 1977. They immediately commenced work on an LP mainly consisting of Sensible songs that the Damned had rejected for being too melodic, but discovered they were one song short for the album. When Mansfield told him to pick out a cover version to make up the shortfall, Sensible considered Waterloo Sunset or See Emily Play, but knocked them back when he realised that he couldn't improve on them. So, on the encouragement of Mansfield, he rummaged through the record collection of his parents, who he was still living with at the time, and pulled out their copy of the soundtrack to South Pacific, the 1949 musical written by Rodgers and Hammerstein, and zeroed in on the song where Juanita Hall gives her daughter and an American Marine that she's knocking off some relationship counselling. When A&M discovered that another artist was ready in a cover of Happy Talk for release, they took a chance and rushed it out as a single 3 weeks ago. And after extensive play on Radio 1, it entered the chart at number 33, which led to a performance on Top of the Pops with Mansfield, Rod Bowkett, a keyboard player and arranger who had worked with Cliff Richard, Stackridge, Fern Kinney, Marty Kane and Bernard Cribbins on the single Make Someone Happy Every Day, which was recorded by Busby, you know, the massive yellow-orange bird who used to nag at you for not ringing up your mam, and Dolly Mixture, an all-woman post-punk trio who were signed to Paul Weller's Respond Records, were once supported by U2 and had just come off the Bad Manners Gosh It's tour. To the amazement of everyone involved, the following week, Happy Talk sold 32 places to number one, becoming the first single ever to jump to number one from a position outside the top 30 and breaking a record which was set by the Beatles in 1968 when Hey Jude jumped from number 27 to number one. I think that's going to be the biggest sword I'll ever do on chart music.
Well, I mean, it's the biggest soaring. That record, that lasts for many, many years, that record.
This is its second week at number one, and he and Dolly Mixture are back in the studio for the third time. Well, Where to begin with this? I'll start with you, David. You obviously knew all about Captain Sensible being at that age in those trousers.
I was
just about aware that he was in The Damned and a punk, but what did the young Neil Kulkarni know of him?
Me? I wasn't aware of The Damned.
No.
Even though I think they might have been on Top of the Pops, I wasn't aware that he was a member of The Damned at all. So what I knew about him was, this record and these appearances.
Yeah.
And did I emerge from that with much sense about who the fuck he was? No, because this performance and this record, to a certain extent, they're kind of a joke I wasn't getting, to be honest with you, at that age. Although, you know, eventually I would come to love certain solo Captain Sensible things like Watt.
Yes.
Watt worked because it's pretty much a pop version of Oggy Oggy Oggy.
Yes.
But, you know, this just seemed odd, this long-awaited return to number one for Rodgers and Hammerstein. Mm. It was just strange, and the performances didn't help much, to be honest with you. I wasn't that familiar with what drunk people look like. Now, of course, I can look at this and think he's pissed out of his face, and he was probably, well, in fact, as later reading of features and interviews with Captain Sensible revealed, he was pretty much drunk for the entire period of the early 80s and was drunk when he made the record. But yeah, what I had in my head was, who is this eccentric chap? But he wasn't captivating particularly. I was much more captivated by the Dolly mixtures, I think, than Captain Sensible.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I would have watched this and my semiotic trousers would have rolled up and down with contempt. Trying to remember, because obviously I knew I would have seen everything in the context of punk and pop entryism or whatever, and that was a project that appeared to be reaching a zenith in 1982, and in the Human League had already cracked number one. But, you know, there were things, there was sort of would-be pop, like Scrutability, there was the Associates, ABC, etc., etc., etc. Now, that was the trajectory that was how you were supposed to go from punk to entryism to pop. Not this, you know, they just cracked it. This is something else. There was the sort of the wing of punk that was in it for the kind of getting pissed and having silly names like Captain Sensible, because he's not sensible at all. He's a bit nutty, it turns out.
Nor is he a captain.
No, he's not. No, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to say this is the wing commander. It's a bit sorry, isn't it? But there you go. I would have. I would have disliked this intensely, and I would have despaired at at the country that was like buying this in droves or whatever, and silver. Kind of, it was all, you know, musical eras like this were precisely equivalent to Thatcher keeping getting re-elected or whatever. It really was. You know,
I mean, when I first heard it and when I heard about it, I was convinced at some point he was going to pull a My Way with Sid Vicious and, you know, start in a sort of serious way, but then just go off on the song.
Yeah.
And as I listened to it the first time, and as it went on, that the realization sunk in that he wasn't going to do that at all. And it was just like, oh God, is that it?
Yeah.
And of course, now it comes off as a big in joke played on the old ones who bought it in droves.
Exactly. Yeah.
But
yeah,
immediately took against it.
Sid definitely didn't die for this, I felt.
No, certainly not.
But no, I think that's true. I think it is just that, basically. It is a sort of parody of the kind of the shit one off St. Winifred type single, basically.
Yeah.
Delivered with, you know, like, you know, a vast, vast dose of sarcasm. But, you know, what is happening is, nonetheless, people are unironically going to record shops and paying unironic cash for it.
Oh, yes.
We're talking about the old ones. We're talking about, there would have been people sitting in living rooms having this beamed at them who would have grown up in the Edwardian age, you know, and I think that this is genuine, nostalgic, feel-good balm, you know, for a certain existing demographic, as it was. And I mean, you know, because you can't, clearly it was an enormous success, and something has to account for that.
It's we'll meet again for the Falklands War, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, friends I'd make later, older friends, they'd say that when this came out, you know, they'd be dealing, if they were working in record shops, with, you know, little old ladies coming in asking for records by Captain Sensible and having to resist, you know, selling them Damn Damn Dan, for instance. it's odd thinking of the fates of that class of 77, if you like. The Jammer in the top 10, the Clash are breaking America, Stranglers kind of in their way, also an oddity kind of record with Golden Brown. They're all finding ways to do stuff away from the centre of pop, perhaps, while still having hits. But this, I mean, this is just, like David said, this is definitive novelty fare. I.e., it's not a... It's weird because obviously it's number one, but it's not a big seller. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those for a few weeks smash midsummer novelty hit that attracts enough attention during a kind of weak sales period to slip up to the top position. You know, it only noticeably spends 8 weeks in the top 75 in total. So the joke obviously wears thin quite quickly for a lot of people. Happy Talk, I looked at the charts for the top 50 best-selling singles of the year, and Happy Talk's not even in that top 50.
Yeah,
that's mental, which, oddly enough, is a distinction it shares with Beat Surrender.
You know,
similarly big smash, but they don't stick around long, and they don't sell that big. Just needs noting, Dolly Mixture, their album that they sort of put together themselves and self-released called Demonstration Tapes, which Bob Stanley, I think, reissued. Bob Stanley's coming up a lot today, isn't he? He reissued it on, I think, his Mint Royale label. It's actually well worth seeking out. That, you know, they had that they were great. But Captain here is clearly as pissed as he was when he was recording it. There's a fantastic interview by the wonderful Carol Clark in Melody Maker with Captain Sensible around about the time this was coming out.
This very week, indeed,
where he says, you know, he backs up everything you said, obviously, Al, about the recording of it. I mean, he says, what can I do with this song? I couldn't play it because it had a key change and I can't play the black notes on the piano. So he says, all I did was go down a pub, get extremely drunk and wait for them to make the music.
Yeah.
And he seems to have continued that drinking all the way through to this appearance, because this isn't just wacky zaniness. This is, he looks trolled, to be honest with you. It's not unpleasant to watch.
No.
But it's not dangerous or anything like that. It's a big, fat fucking laugh.
So that's how he's being portrayed in the music press. Let's have a look at how he's being framed in the tabloids, because there's an article in last week's Sunday Mirror called "This Star Is So Daft. He's sensible. Call him a disgusting slob and he'll love you for it. But clear away the smelly socks and general disorder from his pad and he'll probably spit in your eye. This is Britain's number one hit loony, Captain Sensible. A name specifically chosen because that's what he's not."
Whoa.
Throughout my interview with him, he was hell-bent on maintaining the image of the nauseating layabout. "I have been known to be sick all over myself," he said, "and generally behave in a revolting manner. So would money and newfound stardom change his bawdy habits? Nah, governor," said the former toilet cleaner from Croydon, South London, who now does gigs in the nude. "I won't change. I love living in squalor." And there's a photo of him naked playing the bass. Yeah.
I bet he did not use the word governor.
Thankfully not holding the bass to one side like Ashley out of imagination. we don't see any of that nonsense. I mean, although it predates the TV show by nearly 6 months, to these jaded eyes of mine, Captain Sensible's coming off in the media as a one-man mashup of the Young Ones. You know what I mean? Yeah, He's got that tinge of violence like Vivian. He's got a beret, like Rick. He's a bit of a hippie, like Neil. And I couldn't think of anything to do with Mike, so let's ignore that. You know, he's a lovable layabout.
Yeah.
Who's a bit wacky.
I think there is definitely an understanding, you know, that he has some sort of punk origin. You know, there's a strong inkling, and I think even the old girls who were watching this would have a sense of that.
He was one of them punks.
Exactly. And I think he kind of plays on that. There's that little bit at the beginning of this where he seems to kind of like be kind of like, to the rabbit girls before sort of backing off as if to say, nah, it's all right. We're all right, really. We're just, you know, we're punks and all that, but we're cuddly, really. You know, have a cup of tea.
Yeah. Like the Sex Pistols in that Danny Boyle atrocity.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my God.
I can see again, you know, and I said, this is betrayal. You know, you've deliberately de-radicalised yourself for the kind of Top of the Pops shilling, you bastard.
This is his third appearance on Top of the Pops. What has he come as this week, chaps?
It's sort of Wurzel Gummidge Pirate, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yes, Wurzel Gummidge Pirate. Has he got the bird on his shoulders like the previous one? And Dolly Mixture of Rabbits singing into giant carrots. There's daisies painted on the studio floor. There's tinsel and balloons everywhere. And as in the previous performances, there's a model seagull that's flapping its wings overhead. Looks really realistic. It looks like it's been stuffed, which is a bit grotesque.
But there's a deliberate shitness to it, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a kind of deliberate naffness to it. And I think he is kind of cocking a snook, the sort of po-faced pomposity of certain aspects of new pop here.
Yeah.
There's a very telling quote in the interview with Carole Clark, the aforementioned interview, where he says, "We all liked Happy Talk after we'd done it. I thought it was definitely better than the Human League. I don't like them. They stink of dog shit." So,
nice.
Yeah, very nice. You know, I think he is surprised that this becomes a hit.
Oh, yes.
And he's sort of surprised and delighted, as are Dolly Mixture.
Mm.
It shouldn't have been that surprising, though. I think if you're going to take this particular song, which I've got to say, as ever with chart music, I've been fucking humming this all bloody week because it's an incredibly well-crafted song.
Yes, it is. And it was a song that was known about. It was, absolutely. You know, it was on the national playlist for quite a while.
Yeah, Roger Hammerstein first returned to the charts since You'll Never Walk Alone, actually.
Really?
I mean, it's their first number one since then. A lot of people seem to think You Never Walk Alone is Joey and the Pacemakers song. But it ain't. It's from Carousel, isn't it?
Yes.
I think he's massively surprised. Consequently, he's kind of taken the piss with all of his appearances. But there is a little bit of, look, we're going to use synths. We're going to do this old cover. We're not as po-faced as what else is going on in British pop music at the moment.
Mm. And return for Tony Mansfield. New music. We've raved about them. Not even covered them once on chart music yet, but we're dead keen on them.
Mm.
So good to see him back, but what a shame it's on this.
Yeah. I think that's the trouble, though. Not wanting to be po-faced is part of the British disease.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
I mean, he sings the song straight, which is a bit bad. But then, on the other hand, you know, imagine this in the hands of someone else. He doesn't lean into the pigeon Englishness of the original, which was a song written by two Jewish Americans, sung by a black woman, and mimed to by a mixed-race woman pretending to be Polynesian.
Mm. Imagine if he'd have punked up the vocals. That would have been truly awful.
Oh, fucking hell, yeah.
I mean, I'm not to pick on the guy, but, you know, I imagine Jimmy Percy doing this and something like that happening.
Fucking hell.
Do you know what I mean? Whereas at least he just keeps it flat. And consequently, you know, for the old folk, and let's face it, it is going to be old folk buying this.
Yes.
His punk roots are completely eliminated. He's more of just the kind of wacky, zany Ken Dodd type figure.
Definitely.
Yes.
You know, more than anything else.
I tried to find out who the other major artist was who was thinking of covering this song.
Oh, right.
Couldn't find it anywhere, but I'd take a guess, Anika.
Yeah.
And she's got form for this sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. It'll be part two of a racist trilogy, no doubt. But
it's calibrated to appeal to everybody apart from the people who usually watch Top of the Pops, i.e., people like me. Fucking hated it at the time. Doesn't get played enough for me to hate it now. So, you know, there is that. But the only fond memory I have of this song is that I've got a tape somewhere of me mam singing it to me sister at the time. And when it gets to the "golly baby, I'm a lucky cuss" bit, my sister just says, "Did you say cunt?" And my mam corrects her without batting an eyelid and they carry on. I mean, that was the thing. You just thought, well, there's got to be one time where he just sings, "I'm a lucky cunt." Even if it's unintentional, maybe this would be it, this performance, but no.
He does draw it out a little bit, inviting
of course
kind
of he
supposition.
Does, yeah.
That story you told earlier on about the recording, it just reminded me of, apropos of nothing, really. When I was about 15, and it was my Catholic school, and I had a school essay, and it was just meant to be sort of in the kind of vernacular of a northern man, you know, a sort of hovisty type thing. And, you know, and it was, he kept saying "couldn't" a lot, and quite innocently, you know, I kind of, you know, it says, "You couldn't make it up."
Yeah.
"Couldn't credit it." And I was writing C-U-N-T every time in this thing. And I'm just like, and it came back with this like red rings, you know, my teacher handed back the exercise book, absolutely glowered at me. And it was honestly, I was not being subversive. "You couldn't make it up. You couldn't." The word "cunt" appears 12 times in this short essay. And honestly, I really, really wasn't. I was an innocent boy.
But I also think, I mean, look, this is not a record about nuclear war. It's not a record about Falklands War or anything sort of socio-political, but in a sense, the enforced jollity of it, is in a way making, not a political point as such, but I think that's potentially why it sold so much. That there's no subtext here.
It's not Ghost Town, is it?
No, it's not. It's not.
So the following week, Happy Talk dropped to number 3, being usurped by Irene Cara. The follow-up, the Adamant diss track "What," got to number 26 in September, and his LP, "Women and Captain First," only made it to number 64 in the same month, while the Damned's new LP, "Strawberries," got to number 15. After putting his solo career on hold for 2 years, he left The Damned in 1984, and his next solo release, Glad It's All Over, got all the way to number 6 in April of that year. That's a fucking tune, that is. That's the Great Lost New Music single.
Don't remember that one at all.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Oh, okay.
But diminishing returns set in when his double A-side Christmas Catalogue and Relax, yes, that Relax, only got to number 79 in December of 1984, and he was dropped from A&M. Sensible rejoined The Damned in 1996 and still tours with them today, while his record was eventually broken by Pixie Lott in 2009, when Boys and Girls jumped from number 73 to number 1 in September of that year, because it's the 21st century and the charts don't mean shit.
Well, absolutely. That record, yeah. That record just goes. And before you know it, you're in a world where, yeah, you know, Lily Allen entered the charts last week at 168, now soars to number 3 without that of an eyelid, you know. This kind of stuff happens.
Yeah. No, it's not the same, is it?
Fuck that. Yeah. But it's interesting to learn that your mate's working at the record shop and fighting not to sell Damned records to non-Oz, because I always thought that was a bit of an urban legend.
It would have happened. And the weird thing is, I mean, with Watt coming down the pipe a few months later, Watt was traditionally held up by all the old people that I knew as, you know, this is terrible, not offensive, but kind of ridiculous that this can be a pop song, this kind of back and forth chant. So he's kind of, you know, Captain Sensible is kind of held up in about a few months' time as evidence just how empty and shit pop is. But these were all the fuckers who were buying Happy Talk.
Oh man, the old uns turned the back on Captain Sensible.
They did.
They went off and bought Spread a Little Happiness.
Yeah.
And went to see the film that it was in.
Fickle old bitches.
Yes.
Then still at number one. Next week's Top of the Pops will be introduced by Peter Powell, and this week we're going to leave you with the music of the Steve Miller Band, and moving to it are some magicians from the Human Circus. I think you're going to like them.
Kid, back amongst the throng of zoo wankers, warns us that Peter Powell's coming on next week and signs off with Abracadabra by the Steve Miller Band. Born in Milwaukee in 1943, Steve Miller was the son of a jazz-crazed mum and dad and the godson of Les Paul. When he was 7 years old, the family relocated to Dallas and offered up their back room as a demo studio to the likes of T-Bone Walker, Charles Mingus and Tal Farlow. And the young Steve was encouraged to have a bang on the guitar by Godfather Les. In the mid-50s, he started his first band, The Marksman, which consisted of him, his brother and his best mate at school, Boz Scaggs. And when he started attending the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1961, he started up Steve Miller and the Ardells with Skaggs in tow. They were put on hiatus when Miller went to the University of Copenhagen for his final semester, but he packed it in with only 6 hours of study left to be completed and decided to take his band to Chicago and get immersed in the blues scene of the time. After running into and jamming with Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf and Buddy Guy, he linked up with Barry Goldberg, a keyboard player who was in the Paul Butterfield Blues Band and was a part of Bob Dylan's backing band during his electric performance at the Newport Folk Festival, and they formed the Goldberg Miller Blues Band and moved to New York, but didn't get on with it, and he ended up in San Francisco, where he formed the Steve Miller Blues Band in 1960. After they backed Chuck Berry on the 1967 LP Live at Fillmore Auditorium, they were signed to Capitol, knocked the blues off their name on the recommendation of George Martin, and ended up on the bill of the Monterey Festival in June of that year. It would take 5 years and 8 albums for the Steve Miller Band to get properly sorted out in America when The Joker got to number one on the Billboard chart in January of 1974. And it would take another 2 years after that for their first dent on the UK chart when Rockin' Me, his second US number one, got to number 11 in November of 1976, their only British hit thus far. Earlier this year, when their 12th LP, also called Abracadabra, was being prepared for release, Miller pushed for this to be released as the lead-off single in America, but Capitol Records didn't reckon it at all. However, Phonogram, their European label, were all for it, and it got to number one in Austria, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland. And even the Brits went for it when it came out last month, when it entered the chart at number 38, then soared 26 places to number 2. After an airing of a very expensive-looking video on Top of the Pops, it jumped 8 places to number 4, and this week it's up 2 places to number 2. Now, normally, chaps, that would warrant a pan of the kids and the zoo wankers in the studio or a fisheye view of the studio lights, but hey, it's 1982. Mm. So Michael Hurler's riffled through the classified section of the stage and booked in some magicians to do their pieces in between clips of the video. I mean, he rolled the dice with Trio and came up with whatever's good in craps, which I've never understood. But in this case, he's tried to repeat that trick, and this time, the dice have gone right off the table and under the settee and been hoovered up by his mum and lost forever.
Indeed. I contend. Indeed.
I concur. You contend and I concur, definitely.
Yeah. The magician's not really that magic, is he?
Well, there's three of them.
Well, the one who looks like a kind of mustachioed Fraser Crane, he's bloody awful. Definite animal cruelty issues going on with what he's doing. He starts pulling a variety of species out of a box, and I'm fairly sure a couple of those creatures are dead. They don't seem to be moving much. And then he closes his stuff by pulling a deeply unimpressive amount of handkerchiefs out of a cocktail shaker. A cocktail shaker that looks perfectly adequately sized to contain that many handkerchiefs. It would be more magical for me to pull tissues out of a man-sized Kleenex box. It's not really magic.
Well, no, that's more difficult. You know, the first few, you usually get a right fucking watch, don't you?
That's true. That's true.
I mean, there's one in a dinner jacket who looks just like a zoo wanker, who was actually standing right next to Kid Jensen and kind of like walks off when the song begins and starts dancing before he starts doing his pieces. There's that bloke, the animal cruelty bloke with a receding hairline, but there's someone else with an absolute fucking Uber Keegan of a perm who does ball tricks. Amazing hair.
He looked like, he reminded me of Jim McLaren from Porridge, actually, a little bit, that guy. What's he doing? Kazoo in his mouth, bouncing a football on it? This is not magic.
No.
No. Also with magic requires undivided attention.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Very good, didn't it? You'd have bloody Steve Miller sort of, you know, harping on in the background. It's not an ambient thing.
Well, magicians kind of do suit Top of the Pops in this era, because magicians are all about look at me, look at me, look at me, but they're also about distraction. So you've got loads of zoo wankers doing the look at me bit, and then you've got them, and you've got the video, and you've got the music, and you've got the neon, and you've got the balloons, and you've got the flags, and you just can't focus on anything.
It's a bit of a headache, isn't it? But you do need distraction from what zoo are doing, most definitely.
Of course.
There's an appalling bit where City Farm, they all join hands and they start jumping up and down steps.
It's horrible.
Yes.
It's horrific.
I think near the end, you know, there's a really horrible bit that's sort of like really blokey and space entitled, you know, all those sort of chaps get together. There's sort of people who barge their way onto the centre of the dance floor at the Bally High nightclub or something. Yeah. Thing, you know, there's no grace about it. I mean, Pan's people, there was always grace, wasn't there?
Yes.
A certain, you know, not necessarily gracefulness, they could be, but there was grace in terms of their presence. They didn't feel
there was
invasive.
Dignity.
These feel, yeah, exactly. These people just feel invasive and horrible.
But truth be told, couldn't they have shown the video? Couldn't they just show
yeah.
the video?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Well, but they've already shown the video. They don't like showing the same video twice.
Yeah, but it's a well expensive...
Even though it's 1982, how many times have you seen it?
Well, this is it.
You know, there's no MTV. You might not have... You probably haven't got a video recorder. You know, you're not going to see it on Breakfast Time or TV AM because they don't exist yet. There's no Channel 4.
Mm.
Just show the video.
The song for me, because I'm a kid, I'm an idiot at this time. I mean, look, I love this song. It's well catchy. And it was intimately associated with the video for me. I was annoyed in a sense that it kept cutting to the video and then just depriving us of it and showing us City Farm wankers again.
Which we've seen.
Well, we've seen them. We've seen them plenty of times. We don't need to see them anymore. It is. I mean, I cannot believe that Capital didn't think this was a single.
It's mental, isn't it?
It's mental. It's blatantly the single off any album that it would appear on. It's catchy as fuck. Very, very simple song. But it's simple, catchy, and it has... I'm not saying it's avant-garde or anything, but the guitar solo is kind of mad and kind of wacky and full of sound effects. It's got a similar sort of appeal to the Reflex later on by Duran. It's kind of gimmicky, but absolutely.
It's like being trapped in Defender, isn't it?
It is. Guitar solo. It is, but immensely ear-catching for a kid.
So let's talk about the single. I mean, I've got a very sweet tooth for Steve Miller Band. Fly Like an Eagle and Rocket Man. I've been playing them recently. It's like, fucking hell, these are good.
Nah,
I'm not supposed to like these, but... Fuck it, I do.
Yeah, I would have just hated it. I had a very salty tooth for them, really. it's just slick, white, orthodox. But I will grant you that it is absolutely very, very memorable indeed. I mean, so from that point of view, I mean, it certainly does a job. Horrible lyrics. Very sort of Donald Trump, isn't it? Grab him by the pussy.
Yeah. Well, let me stop you there, David, because it's actually the woman in the song that sings that. Because the lyric goes, just when I think I'm going to get away, I hear the words that you always say.
Oh.
So she's the grabber. And of course, you know, that's all right because of feminism, etc.
Well, I don't know. I think it's still very risky, really, because, you know, he's saying it. If he'd sort of said, abracadabra, I want to greet you, you know, and conveyed a distinctly feminine voice, then he would have been in the clear, absolutely. I want to greet you, I want to grab you. You see, that's obviously a woman.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Such a fine line between sexy and sexist, isn't it?
It is. And the thing is, you know, it's like, who's listening to the lyrics? All you're listening, it's a bit like the Bruce Springsteen thing. Born in the USA. Didn't you listen to the verse? No, of course not. You know, you listen to the key line. So all I ever heard for years and years was a bloke singing, I want to reach out and grab you. I mean, maybe Donald Trump could have used that defense.
In any case, you know, Steve Miller's clearly in a consensual relationship involving magic. So, you know, if he wants to reach out and grab his partner, as long as he's not too grotesque and she doesn't mind and he's not just doing it to show off to his mates, I think that's fair dues.
Well, okay, fair enough. You're a bit more liberal in Nottingham.
Al, why did you have to say consensual relationship involving magic? And I've now got you, obviously, McGee and Daniels in my mind and their scat dungeon. No, sorry.
I think it's a bit doubtful. For years, I think it was a stigma. I think, you know, it affected me. It probably affected my attitudes to women for many years. You know, who's to say? I mean, you know, in your formative years, when you hear these things, you know, the sort of things are sexual.
My case comes up on Thursday. in any case, what else rhymes with abracadabra? I mean, come on.
Well... I know. I mean, it's tough, isn't it? I mean, obviously, he's done it because he was thinking of something that rhymes with abracadabra. I suppose it would be like, hey there, hey there, hey presto, I really want to molest you. Just as bad, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. Or he could have sang, I want to take you to Tesco.
maybe, I suppose. So.
I can scoff at you, David, for being lyrically wrong about abracadabra, but my head is bowed at the moment because talking of lyrics that you didn't get, I've come up with an absolute, wow moment.
Oh, really?
I've had it in my head until today that the lyric in this song goes, silk and satin, leather and lace, Black Betty with an angel's face. Right? Which is a callback to the Ram Jam classic of 1977.
Of
but I've only just realised what it actually is. Do you know what it is?
Go on, then.
Black panties with an angel's face. And that changes everything for me. Because not only a pair of drawers with an angel's face on it would be all kinds of fucking wrong, particularly if it was a biblically accurate angel, as Taylor's pointed out. But now, I mean, all I've thought about all day is Frank Spencer going, ooh, panties. So, yeah.
I never heard the Black Betty thing, but now, of course, I'm thinking about Betty Driver.
Yes. Not in a pair of knickers with a biblically accurate angel on it,
no,
though, eh?
No, I'm going to stop now, actually.
But yeah, Neil, leather and lace. Leather ampersand lace. He's brought that into the into the dictionary.
How astoundingly prophetic of him. And I'm sure he didn't know the legion of shit rock compilations that would ensue. But there it is. David's thoughts are actually very much reminding me of Miles Davis's quote about Steve Miller, which I love. Right. In his autobiography, Miles Davis says, "I remember one time, it might have been a couple of times, at the Fillmore East in 1970, I was opening for this sorry-ass cat named Steve Miller. Steve Miller didn't have his shit going for him, so I'm pissed because I got to open for this non-playing motherfucker just because he had one or two sorry-ass records." I mean, you've got to imagine that in Miles Davis's voice. But,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I just hate the fact that he's called the Steve Miller Band or whatever, you know, it's like no frills, does what it says on the tin. And like, oh, give yourself a name, AC/DC, whatever, you know. But yeah, it's a slick white orthodox, as I say. But it, and I think what really would have bothered me, I mean, you made a list earlier on of all the things that are imminent, Al, you know, like video and Channel 4. This is the very, very last, the last knockings of the era in which pop time is really, really precious. And this, this would have pissed me off because it was really eating into my very precious pop time.
What are you moaning about, David? You're watching fucking Your Heroes West Germany.
Oh, well, I mean, by this
on ITV
point.
Now.
Well, yeah.
So shut up.
Well, to be honest, Al, we all would have been by now, I would have thought, yeah.
I would have flicked back about 3 or 4 minutes in and gone, oh, it's that. It's Abracadabra. Yeah, okay, flick back. You know, because I'd be hoping it was just Who is the 5 o'clock Hero by The Jam. Who suddenly just made an appearance on Top of the Pops out of nowhere. And I was terrified I was going to miss something like that. So I'd have flicked back. And then gone, and flicked back over again.
But I suppose with things like this, precisely because they're actually well-crafted in a way, they don't just occupy precious minutes of Top of the Pops. They sit in your brain. You know, they're earworms or whatever. So they have that kind of add-on insidious effect.
And this was one of the big anthems of the summer of 1982.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't know, life is just very, very different these days. I mean, and I carried this through right into being a music journalist, and for me it justified, you know, the kind of absolute roastings I would give out to music that I dislike because, you know, a song like Baby Jane by Rod Stewart, which I think is the worst song, worst pop song ever made, I just deeply resent the fact that I heard that 80, 90 times and I could play it now in my head. Yeah. I deeply resent that, the way that people resented U2 putting their album out on everybody's you know, mobile phones and all that shit. But now, I don't get bothered in the same way with this anymore. I think like most people, you can just live in a bubble, really. There's rubbish music out there, but it doesn't detain me for one single second. I don't have an opinion on Adele because I have never knowingly listened to an Adele record. You know, she's not eating up space in my head or sort of taking up, you know, like precious time.
The only thing that Adele takes up is that rack in Tesco's where the Tuffies used to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Video's expensive though, isn't it? I like that spinning ball. I still can't work out how they do that.
Yeah.
And they've got animals in it, but it's a white rat being treated nice by a slinky woman who is Joan Severance, who was a model at the time. Yes.
Right.
She later became Hulk Hogan's love interest in the film No Holds Barred. So there you go. That's my second Hulkster reference. Anything else to say about this?
No. I'm saving my Abracadabra story, which you could say would be appetite here. I'm saving it for Halloween. There was a moment in my life where I heard the word abracadabra in a truly terrifying scenario.
Come on, you can't leave it like that,
I was
Neil.
Just lying on my bed, in my flat, in York, right, where I studied. And this flat had a bit of a history to it. We were students and we wanted to move in June, as I recall, for our final year at uni. And we were told by our landlord, no, sorry, you can't. They found a body under the floorboards. They'd found a skeleton. Now, York's obviously an ancient city. It could have been ancient. But we didn't tell one of our roommates, and luckily he got that room. But that room was full. That whole house was full of spooky shit. The one thing I really distinctly recall, and I wasn't doing drugs or anything. I was lying on my bed, listening to something, and I don't know, the record had finished, the needle had lifted, and deep in my ear, well, right in my ear, this demonic voice, genuinely demonic, said abracadabra in my ear, and it scared the living fucking shit out of me. Now, you could say...
Did it reach out and grab you?
No, it didn't. Fuck, but my God, that was scary. I was a suggestible child and teenager and young adult, but I'll never forget that. That was terrifying. I mean, I can listen to Abracadabra by Steve Miller, no problem. It doesn't raise traumatic memories. But, yeah. Oh,
what about if he crept up behind you and whispered it in your ear?
Mate, don't now. That shit me up. Don't even fucking say.
Sorry, man. So the following week, Abracadabra. I don't even want to say it now, Neil.
Oh, it's creepy. It was
the following week. That song stayed at number two for one more week before entering a large box, having swords thrust into it and disappearing out of the charts. However, its success over here and throughout Europe forced the hand of Capitol Records, who put it out in that there Yankee land where they make all the films. And it got to number one for two non-consecutive weeks in September. Fucking hell, man. We're even ahead of the game on America's own fucking singles, man. Useless bastards. Backwater. The follow-up, Keeps Me Wondering Why, only got to number 58 in September, and that was their lot over here for the rest of the decade. But in 1990, Levi's ran an advert where someone who looked like Madonna's latest boyfriend rode a motorbike into a stock exchange office and lobbed his girlfriend some jeans to put on to the sound of The Joker, their 1973 single, and it spent 2 weeks at number one in September of that year.
It is unfathomable to me why this record company thought this wouldn't go down well in America.
I know.
Do you reckon it's because Steve Miller in America has got a bit more of a catch it and kind of people like know who he was, and therefore the contrast with him doing this quite new wavy kind of record might have unsettled them a bit. I don't know, but it's mad because it's an insanely catchy song. Yeah. It's a big, dumb, catchy song for a big, dumb, catchy country, you know. I don't see what the problem is.
I think they worry that the likes of Johnny Fever wouldn't play it because it's too disco.
Of course.
Maybe, yeah.
Mm. Maybe, yeah.
But you see, I would have refused to have danced to this on principle. You know, I was very, very disturbed. There were certain things you didn't matter what, you know, if it was something kind of romantic, Bruno on the dance floor. If this came on, I would absolutely, as a matter of principle, whatever the situation, storm off in high dudgeon. You know, you only dance to funk. It could be white funk, it could be funk, but you do not dance to... I was very strict. I mean, I wouldn't even dance to Motown. I just thought, or if I did, I'd do it in a pointedly sarcastic way. Like, you want to sort of bust some contemporary moves, you know, with some nuanced rhythms and what have you. That's how I felt about it. I was very, very strict about this sort of thing.
Dancing like fucking Andy McCluskey, eh, David? And that, dear boys and girls, is the end of this episode of Top of the Pops. What's on telly afterwards? Well, BBC One whip us straight into the fourth episode of Fame, where Coco's band do a benefit show, but Bruno develops stage fright, but everything turns all right in the end because it's great. Fucking Fame. After the news, it's episode 6 of the drama series Oppenheimer, where the inventor of the atomic bomb starts getting mithered by Joe McCarthy. After that, it's the concert series Night Music, and this week it's a chance to see Sky in concert. Great. Then we go back to David Coleman for highlights of the World Cup semi-finals in World Cup Report, then the weather, then close down at 12:15. BBC Two eventually ensures that my dad doesn't stop me from watching the end of the football by putting on Summer Festivals, where Paul Gambaccini and Fran Morrison take us to the Chichester festivities to see someone play the piano in a cathedral. Then it's news night, highlights from today's cricket, and they shut down at 12:05. ITV are 10 minutes into the West Germany-France game with no goals as yet and unaware that they're about to screen the first ever penalty shootout in a World Cup, which fucks the rest of the schedule right up. So they presumably follow up with news at fucking ages after 10, followed by regional news in your area. Then TVI nips over to Toxteth to find out if any lessons have been learned after last year's riots. Then it's Hill Street Blues, What the Papers Say, and they close down at God knows when. So, boys, What are we talking about in the playground tomorrow morning?
Imagination. Of course, Shalimar for sure.
Yes.
Although probably, you know, with equal avidity to having seen it the first time. Oddly enough, you know, I genuinely did go out and buy Shy Boy by Bananarama. I have a very soft spot for it. I didn't like much Bananarama before then or subsequently, but that one kind of, you know, it got me. Say.
Is that because you were a shy boy, David? Underneath
could
those
be.
Trousers?
Could be. Oh, yes, could well be. Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah.
I think we'd have been talking about, yeah, Jeffrey Daniel, without a doubt, I think it'd be top of the discussion. Probably about how sick we were getting of that Captain Sensible tune. My mates would definitely have been talking about AC/DC. And I think Imagination were always talked about whenever they appeared. So, that's what we'd be chatting about.
What are we buying on Saturday?
So, as a kid, I'd have been getting Imagination Trio. And possibly that's about it. As an adult, Odyssey, Shalimar, DC, in fact, quite a lot of them.
Yeah, what a strike rate in this episode.
There is, definitely. And sorry, another thing I would have been talking about probably, in fact, inevitably, would have been which member of Bananarama I fancied the most, which was probably Karen.
I would have bought, I actually did buy Odyssey. Course, and I did buy, as I said, but the Bananarama. It was the only Bananarama record I ever bought, and I think that's about it. I would have probably not bothered this time with Imagination. Already got it, really. And of course, I would have already got Don't You Want Me, and I should sort of not been quite so much up my own arse and actually invested in AC/DC. He might have made a man of me, but I didn't. And I was just disappointed. I had high hopes for a Trio and Da Da Da, and I felt they were dashed, really. So,
But hey, we got a decent chocolate bar out of them, didn't we? Trio doing the advert music for Trio would have been fucking amazing. With that girl. And Derek Griffiths, fucking hell.
They could have done a whole album of that, man. They could have done the United one as well. You know,
yes.
My name is San, I am a fan, all of that.
I am the boss, and sometimes I get cross. And what does this episode tell us about July of 1982?
Well, you know what? It was a lot more interesting than I might have thought, I think.
Yes.
You know, I think pop's getting more colourful in a way. Than the kind of glowering early 80s years. Things at the moment, when this episode comes out, they could have gone kind of one or two ways. We could have ended up with more perversity and oddness, if you like, a la Trio, or we could have gone more competence and slick professionalism, as in all the shit that Jonathan King throws at us.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Jonathan King's world wins. As I think 83 and 84 prove. But things are still sort of nicely up for grabs in this period in a way that I wasn't expecting.
I think this tells us that 1982 has got to be taken really seriously as one of the great years of music.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we have to extend that golden age out from 1979 right past 1981 and into at least the middle of 1982. I think the problem with 1982 is, like 1980, it's a year stuffed with brilliant music, but the number ones are shit. Because the old uns and the Norals and the kids are still having their say. The toddlers. What a high water mark of humanity July of 1982 is. This kind of quality on Top of the Pops and a decent World Cup. Fuck hell. Take me back there, please.
Great times. And I would agree. I think I'd ultimately probably plump for 82 as the greatest pop year. Simon makes a strong case for 81, you know, and I think it is a strong case. I thought it was a great year too. And then 83, the descent begins. I mean, it's Howard Jones, Nick Kershaw, who are just kind of peroxided chancers, basically, who don't have this kind of punk trajectory.
Yeah.
And actually, the Smiths, although I loved them at the time, they're the kind of, you know, the first white group in ages, you know, coming from that sort of Mancunian background, who are clearly... Who, without funk, who have no relationship, indeed have a disdain for black music, well, Morrissey certainly. And I think that in itself, you know, although the Smiths, early Smiths records are very great, they represent a kind of re-Caucasianifying, as it were, of rock and pop music. And, you know, they're the first group to break off that relationship with great black music that you had since punk.
Yeah, and in 82, kids are still into music, if you like, that is... And when I say kids, I mean not little kids, yeah? Like you said out a few minutes ago, you know, little kids and old uns. I mean, teenagers, they're into music that their parents can't fathom out and that their parents think this isn't proper yes. music. Whereas in 83, yes. those kids are into things like David said, Howard Jones. You know, Howard Jones is never going to rub an older person up the wrong way with his feather cut and his basically sort of synthy prog type music. Whereas in 82, there is still that thing of, I mean, I remember my parents saying to me, this is barely music. That's what you want to hear as a kid. You really want to hear that. You know, that is what you want to hear. Whereas in 83, I don't think that's happening as much. So, an underrated year, 82, as this episode proves, really.
Whereas I was almost saying to my daughter, Alicia, you know, this isn't noise, it's just music.
And so we come to the end of another episode of Chart Music. Oh, all that remains for me to do is the usual promotional flange. So, www.chart-music.co.uk, facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast, reach out to us on Twitter at chartmusictotp, money down the G-string, patreon.com/chartmusic. Thank you, Neil Kulkarni.
As ever, a pleasure.
God bless you, David Stubbs.
A pleasure indeed.
My name's Al Needham, and golly baby, I'm a lucky cunt.
Chart Music.
Designer in New York or Paris tell you what to wear. Clothes express your personality, so express yourself and not someone else. Do Calvin Klein, Bill Blass, or Gloria Vanderbilt wear clothes with your name on it? No, of course not. So you table the label and wear your own name. All dressed up with no place to go. No sweat, says Kelly. I'll just run around the block a few times. And she probably won't be running alone in this versatile outfit. Perfect for stopping traffic and starting. Who knows what? Manny. All the breaks have been going well for Manny. He's wearing the B-boy look. Need for breaking, and boy, do that look tough.
David.
Who's the hippest cat in town? Ain't no doubt when
David
around with
semiotic trousers
and hair and thinness, he's the 80s nod to 50s splendor. Stay cool,
David.
Just a man and he's still too high. Long ago, when we were young and free, love happened suddenly, and we could not see where we were going wrong. Now, those old days, they're fucking gone.